Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, and we are 2 days away. We are 2 days away from the 253rd St. Patrick's Day Parade in New York City. The Vice Chairman is with me today, and I would indeed love to welcome indeed, John Leahy, you're very welcome.
Great, it's great to be here, isn't it? We last spoke on the radio in Ireland. So.
In Ireland, and indeed at what was a very exciting trip.
It was indeed.
And among other, just to give us maybe a recap of that last trip.
Well, thanks to you and your help. You know, we were in Ireland. I've been there over a dozen times in the last 10 years. But to have the honor of meeting with the President of Ireland and the Taoiseach of Ireland, it was mostly in conjunction with Quinnipiac University and our Ireland's Great Hunger Museum. Mm-hmm. We were also there to be part of Judy Collins' taping of a live concert from Ireland that Quinnipiac University helped to support. We were with the Irish arts and the educational community. We met with the people at Maynooth, where we're going to have a cooperative program in Irish studies.
And for many on that trip, and we were delighted to be included on that trip to Ireland, but you have made numerous trips to Ireland, and indeed you have your representatives have been in Ireland mostly in connection with artwork, and as you mentioned to the President and indeed the Taoiseach, there's a trove of art in Ireland that has been there. And it just shows up for you know, being in attics, that's been in, and indeed a lot of collectors, I don't know whether this is peculiar to Ireland or not, but a lot of collectors don't want to acknowledge that they have some prized possessions.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, as I said, Irish art and the visual arts in general that the Irish have consumed is really underappreciated. I think it's underappreciated in Ireland, and I know on a worldwide basis it certainly is. And so it's a little perplexing to me, the views of art there. Thankfully, the Irish have gotten some appropriate recognition from literature and theater and music. But I think the visual arts, their day is coming, thanks to Brian Burns and the work that we've done at Quinnipiac University. I think we're not only at our Ireland Great Hunger Museum, educating people about the Great Hunger and its true causes and consequences. But I think also it's given us an opportunity to educate people in this country and beyond about the very significant contributions the Irish have made to the visual arts.
The chicken and the egg, with respect to what most people now recognize, and we all recognize, the first of its type, Ireland's Great Hunger Museum in Hampden, Connecticut, and you as founder, that actually you had for a long time, and in your interest in Ireland, and then particularly through the St. Patrick's Day Parade, you are a former Grand Marshal, you had developed an interest and a great interest in the exposure of the story of the Irish famine. And at some point you must have felt that art and the tremendous wealth of art would probably be a very unique way, and would be, you needed a museum to accommodate the art.
No, I think so. I think, you know, like music, art is universal. It transcends language, and it communicates in a very powerful way. And unfortunately, particularly in a tragedy, to communicate a tragedy. Yeah. It's one thing to read, a very well-written book by Christine Keneally, This Great Calamity, which certainly documents the history, and it's wonderfully written. But art, as I think our museum has accomplished, the graphic representation and the visual nature of a tragedy, whether it's a Holocaust in our Holocaust museums, or in this case, the Great Hunger, I think art is a particularly effective medium and vehicle for communicating the suffering and the death and the tragedy that was the Great Hunger. So I think you're right. I certainly had a sense about that. But I must say, you know, I purchased just about every piece in our collection over a period of time of 15 years since 1997, thanks to Murray Linder and his brother Marvin generously supporting my efforts. But it really, even for me, the dedication of a museum about a year and a half ago now, to get all of that art together in one place. The museum is a very powerful place, and it even touched me in an emotional and powerful way that first time I saw it in its totality. So, and we've had 15,000 people visit the museum in just the last 16 months, and so the word is getting out, and it's I couldn't be happier, both with the efforts we've had and the success we've had in educating people about the Great Hunger, but also about the art that is part of that wonderful museum.
Many who are born and raised in Ireland would have a tremendous reluctance to speak about our tragedies, and in particular the famine, the Great Hunger, primarily because it was accompanied by some sense of guilt, survivor guilt. Now, a Bronx boy, Bronx Irish American, did that kind of translate and transfer to this country as well?
Well, you know, I think I'm not surprised that the museum is here in America. I'm not surprised that we don't yet have a large museum in Ireland. We have different places where they've commemorated the famine. And I think the reason, Adrian, is for the Irish, even to this day, it's, yes, the guilt and the victim sort of mentality.
Right.
And I think it's a little easier for Irish Americans or the Irish diaspora to look back on that painful period, because we can balance the tragedy and the deaths and the suffering with the fact that we came to this country, or my grandfather, my great-grandfather, just after the famine, came here, and the Irish have a lot to be thankful for and a lot to be proud of, the accomplishments of how we transformed this great city of New York, for example, Boston, and many cities in this country. So I think it's a little easier for us because the famine has two sides to it. We certainly share in the tragedy and the suffering that the people of Ireland went through. But on the other hand, the famine for us also is the triumphal accomplishments and success of Irish America. So I think it's a little easier for us to look back on it, and that's why I'm not surprised that that Irish America was maybe the first place where we have a museum of that kind.
Right.
And it may be, as you know, the 150th anniversary in 1997 of the famine.
Right.
That was the first time the Irish government actually commissioned some artwork and actually had some a number of events to commemorate the famine.
Right.
I'm told that the 100th anniversary in 1947, almost nothing was said or done. And that was 100 years. Yeah. So it tells you how painful that tragedy was for even 100 years later. And then it took 150 years separation from the actual event in order for the Irish government to do what it did, which was terrific, which I think led to a lot of the activities here in this country as well.
Right. Well, again, this necessity to be on the defensive. Ireland's government was very new at that point as well, when it, you know, and probably And that one wasn't exactly a rip-roaring success. So it might have been that the government chose to say, listen, we're not in great shape now to talking about, you know, about something as awful and as, you know, that might have had something to do with it. But all in all, the 150th was not... Mm. Was not going to go by, and it wasn't going to go by in America anyway, that's for sure. Mm. And so the whole attitude indeed has very much changed, and some of it indeed is has to have some bearing of the success of the St. Patrick's Day Parade in New York, of which you are chairman. And did you've been involved for a quarter of a century.
I have, indeed.
How, if we can go back to your own house and growing up and your awareness of the significance of the parade, what were your first impressions as a kid, as a child?
Well, just the, you know, the importance of it and the... as I said, growing up in an Irish Catholic neighborhood in the Bronx, I thought everyone was Irish because everyone I contacted pretty much was. The priest was Irish, my teachers were Irish, the policeman, the cop on the beat was Irish, the fireman. And there were two holidays, basically, in my family that we celebrated, and Christmas and St. Patrick's Day. And so I think those that are not Irish appreciate what Christmas is like for Catholic families in particular and Christians. And but St. Patrick's Day in my household was on the same level. We didn't exchange presents, but we went to a lot of activities. And I remember my parents taking me to the parade as a young kid. I don't remember my first parade. I marched in the parade when I was in high school, with Fordham Prep, when I was 14. But I had been to several parades earlier with my parents. And I just had, you know, the feeling of pride. The parade has always been a very dignified parade. And it also, I think more so than any other parade in New York, is really embraced by the entire city. Now, the city back then when I was a kid was, you know, the mayors were Irish, everyone seemed like was Irish, even outside of my neighborhood in the city. But even till this day, no other parade. We have some wonderful parades in New York, certainly the Columbus Day Parade and the Palatine
so many
Day
of them,
Parade.
Yeah.
Oh. They're all, but the St. Patrick's Day Parade to this day is embraced by everyone. I wouldn't say everyone wants to be Irish that day, but and so it sort of had a transcending importance that, you know, to me as a kid, it must be important to be Irish. As I said, when you grow up as a kid, you take everything for granted. This is the way it is. And as I said, everyone just about I had contact with was Irish. But that parade, when you came down to the city, Manhattan, and saw the size of the parade and all the county organizations and the thousands watching it, and it was televised back in those days on WPIX so it just built in me a sense of pride in being Irish.
But there is one parade, and it is the New York Parade. It is the Fifth Avenue. That is a parade that has drawn the attention of the diaspora, no question about it. And amazingly, considering that there are thousands of St. Patrick's Month events all around the world, there has to be hundreds or again, starting with thousands of different parades around the world. Mm. But there is something about the St. Patrick's Day Parade, well deserved, if you figure that we're talking about 53 by Monday, years of continuous parades through what had to be some of the darkest periods in American history, in New York history, much less anything else, that somehow this is the one. This is where we, this is the marker for St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, I think without question, Adrian. And, you know, I'll probably sound like an arrogant New Yorker, but whatever we do in New York, the great things and maybe the not so great things are magnified as all over this country, indeed all over the world. I think certainly the fact that we have St. Patrick as both the patron saint of Ireland, the patron saint of the Archdiocese of New York, that we have St. Patrick's Cathedral. So
we got a lock.
Yeah, it's it is the greatest parade anywhere in the world, and as with so many other things in New York, I mean we've always been the biggest city in the country, and communications capital of the world, your industry, the financial capital of the world, and Wall Street, and what happens here in New York is certainly recognized throughout this country and throughout the world. So, not surprisingly, the St. Patrick's Day Parade is in that same category.
As co-chair of the St. Patrick's Day Parade, you know, I think there are still some who are so struck and awed with the parade itself. That they may feel that commitment to the St. Patrick's Day Parade, that's going to have everybody come to New York, that somehow the bands come, that somehow those straight lines, that the marchers, you know, that all of the, those, that it just somehow falls together. And even, everybody doesn't very little recognition of the enormous organization that doesn't start the week, the month before, starts the day after the last one.
No, absolutely, and it's entirely a volunteer group. I think we might have at this stage maybe a part-time secretary in an office up in Yonkers, but other than that, you know, the chairman of the parade, John Dunleavy, who's been the parade chairman I think for 25 years now, and Frankie Byrne before him, and Judge Comerford,
those are the three that
I've worked with, and myself, and Hillary Byrne, and all volunteers. I'll be at an event this evening. We call it the Workers' Meeting. We'll be at Cathedral High School. There'll be about 100 to 125 people there tonight. They're all volunteers. Again, they're the people who are in charge of the line of march. They're evaluating for awards that we give out to the different marching groups. We have security people and people who are going to handle the seating at the cathedral is our responsibility. The TV production that I'm involved with directly now with NBC. And so you're right. It's a almost year-round operation, entirely a volunteer operation and has been throughout its history. We have a recognition event. In fact, the first event after this each annual parade, we give some recognition to the volunteers who have helped us and worked in the year. But you're right, it's a tremendous effort, we hope it goes off smoothly, and it looks like it's well organized, and indeed it is, but it's remarkable in many ways, as you're pointing out, that it's all done by volunteers, but it's a large group of dedicated volunteers who, year in and year out, and I'm not unusual. John Dunleavy must be involved with the parade for close to 50 years. So these people have been involved with it literally for a long, long time, and of course we get support from the Irish organizations, the county organizations, the AOHs, and the Emerald Society. So
what do you say to those who bemoan the fact, as a matter of fact, I can go back and I'm now, believe it or not, 55 years in New York. And I remember coming here and people saying, oh my God, I don't know what's going to happen when these old people aren't around anymore. The sky is going to fall. We'll have lost our identity, and it only gets worse from that point on. It's absolutely easy to see that there are very seasoned organizers who have a lifetime of commitment to the parade. Projecting forward, what do you think will be the glue to hold that together?
Well, we are bringing in some into the organization some younger people, so we certainly, you know, Hillary Byrne, I don't even know how old Hillary is, but he's a lot younger than I and John Dunleavy for sure. And there are other people, Frank McGrail. I mean, his dad, Frank, I knew him very well, was involved with the parade for 30 or 40 years. So, of course, Hillary is the nephew of Frankie Byrne.
Frankie,
so,
yeah. It's in the genes.
No, I think it is. And Mike Castle's, you know, his dad, Pete, who just passed away a little over a year ago. So, you know, the sons and the grandsons, we're continuing that tradition. So I think, but we're always on the lookout, and you're right. Some of us are certainly getting up there in years, and it's always a challenge. But we have been successful, I think, in bringing on to the parade young people early on. And so I'm confident there will be future leaders there, just as there have been in the past.
I'm sure I would be criticized if I didn't draw attention to the fact, you know, that immigration and there hasn't been, we have lost actually a generation of Irish born, who are missing. Even if immigration reform was resolved tomorrow morning, we're still missing a chunk there of actually 30, 40 years and longer if we go back to 65. But to counter that, we have the New York parade for as long as we can remember is an Irish American parade, and in fact it is a New York parade. And as such, whether the participants are from Jersey or Connecticut or for that matter, you know, anywhere on the East Coast, it's an American, it is definitely it's America's melting pot in its true form to watch that.
Oh, absolutely. I was just speaking with the new leader of the 69th Regiment, who is Irish himself, but I was talking about the members of the Fighting 69th. You know, they still lead the parade every year. They still come to the cathedral, and just in the 25 years that I've been connected with the parade, you know, that was obviously the Irish Brigade going back to the Civil War days.
Absolutely.
And it reflected New York. The people who were part of that National Guard armory here in Manhattan were Irish back then. It then evolved over the years, and there were many more African Americans and Hispanics as a member of that.
Right.
And now Sean was telling me that the new group now is Eastern Europeans. I mean, not surprising, given the new wave of immigrants and where they're coming from. So it's as you said, a great melting pot to think this is the most Irish of Irish parades, the biggest Irish parade, and who's leading this parade? The Fighting 69th, I don't know what the percentage of Irish in it, but it's probably 5% at most. But, you know,
but if you go to the New York Armory, and by the way, we should point out that the connection, you know, with the Armory and with the Fighting 69th is none other than the leader himself, John Dunleavy. He has an enormous entree and history, you know, with the Armory and with that whole.
Oh, absolutely. Group. But it's wonderful to see that, as you say, the great melting pot. And it's and again, I see the faces of, you know, they're just as proud as, you know, Puerto Rican Americans and African Americans and from Lithuania and Poland and the East German, European immigrants of more recent years that are flocking into our city. You know, they're just as proud to be part of the 69th Regiment and just as proud to be leading the parade up Fifth Avenue. So, you're right. New York is a wonderful melting pot, and you could just study the history of the parade, study the history of the 69th, the Fighting 69. You can see the evolving of the immigrant groups in this city, and right. So it's you're absolutely right. It's a great melting pot, continues to be, and that also binds us all together. We have the immigrant experience. You know, one of the reasons I've mentioned that Murray Lender funded the Great Hunger Museum, he identified his parents had to flee Poland. And thankfully, they did in the 1930s. They saw what was coming, you know, in Poland. And he understood what it meant for his parents to have to give up everything, leave their native country, come to the United States, learn a whole new language, and he very much, it wasn't just the suffering and death that the Irish went through that Murray could identify with in terms of the Jewish experience. It was the immigrant experience itself of how
right.
difficult that is and challenging. So I think, again, that's what's great about the St. Patrick's Day Parade and the fact that everyone identified, because we're all immigrants, and all immigrants have a very similar experience and a challenge. So I think it's wonderful that the parade in this time in New York City
right.
is led literally by a group of immigrants that came here and had similar experiences.
27 years ago, you arrived at a university not very well known. It was a campus. It was an area that had little more than 100 acres. And that very same area right now, more than 600 acres. And two other prominent additional campuses. One, 250 acres, mm-hmm. which encompasses the TD Bank sports arena. Mm-hmm. And the newest one of 100 and so acres. Start, if you will, and we work our way backwards. The newest campus and the newest branch of Quinnipiac University, having had a great reputation in many areas, mm-hmm. taking on medicine mm-hmm. and healthcare, mm-hmm. that is huge.
You know, it is. Thank you for mentioning it. The third campus that we just opened a few years ago, we call it our North Haven campus. All three campuses are within 5 minutes of one another. But we moved our School of Health Sciences there 3 years ago and our School of Nursing. We currently have under construction our law school, which will be moving this summer to that campus. But then we added our newest school just a year or so ago, our new School of Medicine, which we received a very large eight-figure gift for that has been named the Frank Netter School of Medicine. And we just opened that this past September. So it's a wonderful campus, and medicine, as you know, is going through some tremendous changes, and there's a great need for more primary care doctors in particular. So Quinnipiac not only has a new medical school, but we have three institutes, one in global public health that we hope to work in Ireland with the medical schools there in Cork and elsewhere. We're also going to have an institute for rehabilitation medicine that's going to provide rehabilitation services, particularly for veterans who need those services. But we're also going to have an institute in primary care that's going to have our physician assistant programs that we have in our School of Health Sciences, our nurse practitioner programs that's in our School of Nursing, and physicians, our medical students, trained together as a team, kind of the primary care team that's very much needed in healthcare today. It's not only going to be a great medical school, but a unique medical school that's going to provide, and our hope is, if we educate our nurses and our physician assistants and our doctors together, educate them in the same facility, in the same campus, the hope is that they'll be a much more effective team working in the healthcare industry. So I'm very proud of the Frank Netter School of Medicine, and we're enrolling our second class of 90 students this coming September, we received 5,500 applications for the 90 seats. So
incredible.
And the quality of the students is just unbelievable.
I want to come back to something you've mentioned a couple of times, and indeed how Ireland's Great Hunger Museum got its start in the first place. God knows you as the founder and somebody who had, if we go back to the year where you served as Grand Marshal of the famous St. Patrick's Day Parade, you ruffled a few feathers back then, including Irish government. We should point out previous Irish governments, but by drawing attention, you know, now very publicly, as we've acknowledged, greatest parade in the world, St. Patrick's Day Parade, adopting rather safe themes, and here's this guy, Leahy, from the Bronx, coming down, stirring things up that you had to know was going to be, you know, a kind of a thorn, not only to the British side and to the to those, but also to the Irish, and saying, "Oh God, are we gonna go through this again?" That commitment, I think, for once and for all, the line was drawn, and it was drawn by you. Now, how history will record whether you should have left it alone or not is beside the point. Now, but tell us about that and your awareness and your need as, you know, as the president of a very well-known and now strong university. Was there a part of you that might have said, I wonder if I'll get away with this as such?
Well, you know, I didn't. The thought never entered my mind, you know. Wrong often, but never in doubt, I guess, is what they say about leaders. And, you know, it was a little bit of the educator in me that I felt that, you know, being Grand Marshal is a platform. You know, you not only, you know, proudly lead the parade up on Fifth Avenue that day, but you have an opportunity to speak at most of the Irish organizations have their annual dinner dance, and they invite the Grand Marshal. So it's really a platform, an opportunity. And the other thing, I think a lot of the Grand Marshals before me, many of them were born in Ireland, or at least their parents were born in Ireland.
Yeah.
And most of them talk about themselves and their Irish experience and
that's
and
what you live for. Yeah.
And I just I didn't think my life personally was all that interesting, and my Irish roots, you know, my grandfather on my father's side was obviously born there. But I guess a combination of I'm not one to talk about myself much at all, and then with the educator in me, I didn't want to lose an opportunity to do something important. And then, you know, it wasn't that I thought of this, you know, out of thin air. Just a year or so earlier, I had read Christine Keneally's book, This Great Calamity. And, you know, and like so many, yes, I heard about the famine, but we didn't talk about it a lot at home. It was just sort of this dark cloud in the past. And we knew that's why we were here in New York, and so I wasn't any more educated about the true facts back then. And I read Christine's book, and the more I read it, you know, the angrier I got about the, you know, when you really document what happened there. It wasn't, yes, the potato crop failure happened, but if the British government, who was ruling Ireland during that time, there's more than adequate food in Ireland, and literally the thing that really got me, the export of food out of Ireland during the years from 1845 to 1850 actually increased each and every year. While the deaths were going down, the starvation was going down, the suffering. So, you know, I had read her book, and then again, both in Ireland, there was 1997, and there were talk about things happening for the 150th anniversary. As you well know, and you were a major influence, Governor Pataki signed legislation that year.
Right.
He was roundly criticized. I think it took more courage for the governor here and our legislature.
There are some who say you actually dragged him down with you, but that's...
So in any
neither way... Neither one would have... It wasn't a very popular...
No, you're right.
But as I say, for once and for all, the word was out.
Yeah, no,
there was no backtracking from that.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I was criticized, not only by the British government officials, but I won't name... There was one person in the St. Patrick's Day Parade Committee who mentioned after the initial press conference when I was introduced, he said, leave that famine stuff aside, will you? And so I didn't tell him at the time that he was going to hear a lot more about the famine if he was upset with just my
I would say
comment.
Also that if he got... even a small sum of money for those if they didn't say it directly to you would have thought of it. This is a Catholic parade. Let's keep it a Catholic parade. let history take care of itself. It doesn't belong on Fifth Avenue. You brought it to Fifth Avenue.
Yeah, and as I said, you don't get many opportunities to have a platform like that. I don't think people realize, in fact, I don't think all of our grand marshals in past years have really used it for the opportunities that it provides to talk about something, you know, larger than yourself and even larger than the parade. I mean, a parade's important, and you know, accurately recording history and commemorating the suffering of literally millions of people and an event, as I said, I have both the positive and the negative. And while we talk mostly about the famine and the suffering and the we have the positive side of that in terms of what the Irish have done in this country. You know, when they came here, they built the canals and the railroads. They made the Catholic Church the largest, most influential church in America. They helped create the public school system, the parochial school system. They became the mayors and the Paul O'Dwyer's of the world. When you think of what the Irish did for this country and this city in particular. So that's a that also those things wouldn't have happened absent the famine. As I'm going to be speaking at the Friendly Sons of St. Patrick, and one of my closing lines in my speech there on Monday night will be that I hope we never forget that our American dream started with an Irish hunger, so I think. All the good things we've had too have their origin and their place in what was obviously a terrible tragedy for Ireland.
You've mentioned Christine Keneally a couple of times. You read her book, you spread the word, and one would have thought that having founded Ireland's Great Hunger Museum and that has a legacy and a lasting gift. You have a university to run. You have a very successful university. And as you've, Quinnipiac has been known, you know, for the advancement of law and now in healthcare and medicine, something was bugging you for some time. There are many universities throughout the United States that have Irish studies programs, but you narrowed that down and collared Christine Keneally. Tell us about that.
I did. It took me a few years. It wasn't an easy sale with Christine, you know, the museum is a very important part of Quinnipiac, and for something to really have roots and to be part of a university on a permanent basis, it really has to be tied into the university's academic mission. And we don't have an art major, so, you know, the museum is not going to be tied into a strong art department. So part of my thinking was, in addition to having the museum, we really needed to have something rooted in the academic part of the university. So we've created Ireland's Great Hunger Institute, which is going to produce conferences and publications and and research. So it'll be an academic research institute. It's part of our history department. I was able to convince our history department and dean of our College of Arts and Sciences that having this as part of their mission made sense. And then obviously we needed hopefully a nationally or internationally recognized leader to head up that institute, and that's why I worked on Christine for the better part of 2 or 3 years and convinced her to come to Quinnipiac as professor of history, professor of Irish studies, and to serve as the founding director of the Ireland Great Hunger Institute. So I think the two of them together now, the institute very much rooted in the university's academic mission, that will be there. And having the museum in conjunction with that, I think will make sure that the museum and its mission will be an important and permanent part of Quinnipiac for well beyond the John Leahy years as president, and in a substantive way. And ultimately, you know, ideas matter. I don't think had I not read Christine's book just a year before I was tapped to be the Grand Marshal. I'm not sure I would have made that the theme of the parade, and had I not done that, those speeches would not have been heard by Murray Lender and others, and you know, but for those things, there might not be Ireland's Great Hunger Museum. So I want to make sure, since some of these things do happen by chance, that now that it's there, I want it to be continue its work on a permanent going forward basis.
We finally, I'd like again to draw attention to the commitment of Taoiseach Enda Kenny, who in fact is committed to not only visiting Quinnipiac University, but also primarily because of Ireland's Great Hunger Museum. But in this weekend, where there were all kinds of commitments, many of them, I think the feeling was that his visit was going to be much more significant than swinging by. That is also something that you have found in Ireland. Maybe in Irish America here, they say, oh, that's the fellow with the polling institute. But when you go to Ireland, there is that recognition that somehow, you know, that you have created that atmosphere, which has actually spread. It has spread back into Ireland. It has spread through a lot of the world where, again, the Great Hunger was, you know, written about so often and so many. It was one topic that one would have felt enough has been written about. It would have been the Irish famine, the Great Hunger. And yet, Christine Keneally comes and pretty much tells it like it is, without trying to, in fact, as the true historian was there, cut the, you know, a lot of the fat and the trauma. There's enough trauma in it. The story is told accurately. That this was new, that this is something that, you will remember that the teacher again said, you know, in reading when Christine's book was presented, that he said, I've read some, but I'm going to read this from cover to cover. Now, there's somebody who has obviously read a lot of books on history, and again, pertaining to the famine. But there is a recognition that, okay, this is not a novel. This is historical fact. And in fact, nobody has challenged any part of her. So it has a meaning. It has a something great.
Oh, no question about it. And again, I appreciate the role that you played in setting up our meeting with Taoiseach, and As I indicated to them, Quinnipiac would like to honor him, hopefully while he's in office, to give him honorary
number one on the next trip.
I mean,
is the way it was presented. It is a commitment, but it's a commitment to do other than just, this is not going to be a flyover. So it is.
Yeah, no, and he said he's excited about seeing the museum, and you're right, you know, in Ireland, Quinnipiac is known for the Great Hunger Museum, and I've been to many of the universities there now. Of course, it's also a great destination place for our students. The largest number of our study abroad students is in Ireland, actually, and a very large number of them
are
in Cork. And I'm sure there'll be many more with Maynooth as we do that joint program with them in Irish Studies. But we'll be truly honored, and I hope I'll be seeing the Taoiseach here at on St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah.
He's scheduled to be up in the booth. We hope to be interviewing him again and with Tommy and Teresa. But you're absolutely right. The recognition that we received in Ireland for this has been very gratifying and humbling, quite honestly. And as you know, to think of it, that the head of government of Ireland would come over to Hamden, Connecticut, in the greater New Haven area, and mostly when heads of state come to the greater New Haven area, they stop by that little college down the street from us, Yale, that most people don't know much about. But it will be great when the Taoiseach comes, and it is a source of great pride for us that this has been a project that Irish Americans have responded to, but the recognition and the appreciation that genuinely been given to me and to the university for this museum from the highest levels of the presidents and the Taoiseach in Ireland is very humbling and very gratifying.
Good luck on Monday. Good luck to all of us, because if the weather forecast is anything to be, if we believe even half of it, it's not going to be a bright, sunny day. But after your 25 years on the avenue, you'll be ready for anything.
I always say St. Patrick's Day is either the last day of winter or the first day of spring, and most often it's the last day of winter, and I'm afraid this year that's what it'll be like, but the
great
pride
in
being Irish will be, Jack O'Hearn will be a wonderful, again, another reflection of what the Irish have done. When you think of labor movement in this country, and the labor leaders in this country, he's one of the great ones, and we're honored to both honor him as an individual, but also the labor unions that the Irish built and led for many generations here in America.
Despite too many titles, I think we could end on this lead-up to the 253rd St. Patrick's Day Parade coming up 2 days from now. The Vice Chairman, John Leahy, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Adrian.